From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Russia is celebrating its annual Victory Day parade to mark the end of World War II in Moscow. Russia's Ministry of Defense said more than 13,000 soldiers filled Red Square, joined by more than 70 aircraft and 200 units of military hardware. May 9th is commemorated annually in Russia to mark the victory of the Soviet Union over Nazi Germany in 1945. CCTV's Edwin Marr has more.
Certainly a fine sunny day in Moscow. It's just gone 10 o'clock in the morning for this, the annual Victory Day parade to mark the end of World War II. There'll be tanks, there'll be howitzers, there'll be armoured personnel carriers, all kinds of vehicles taking part in this parade, which is held every year to mark the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in 1945.
Russia's role as the primary victor over the Nazis has been all but forgotten here in the U.S., where generations of Hollywood movies and selective history have placed the U.S. at the center of the effort. RT's Guyan Chachikayan and Caleb Maupin spoke with people on the streets of Washington and New York asking one simple question about that war. This is what it sounded like.
We are near the White House.
We're here in New York City.
We're going to ask Americans which countries
played the greatest role in defeating the Nazis during the Second World War. Let's take a listen.
I say the United States of America.
United States, England, Poland, Russia.
The U.S. and Britain? I don't really know.
Okay, shoot. We just went to the Holocaust Museum, and I wish I could remember which countries. France?
France. Can you think of another country?
America.
Can you think of another country?
Britain.
What about the Soviet Union?
Yeah, that was a portion of it I remember seeing in there, that there was a pretty good-sized portion dedicated to that.
Ask any American on the street if they've ever heard of the Battle of Stalingrad. I doubt it.
The former Soviet Union? The
United States. Austria was part of it. Japan lost. Russia lost.
Yep. Seriously?
Which country took Berlin? Which army?
United States.
The largest role had the most casualties in the fight against the Nazis during the Second World War.
Oh, that's better.
I'm like totally blanking. It's not the U.S.
The Allied forces. It was England. It was the United States. It was Belgium. It was France. It was Canada. Who else was a part of the
Soviet Union?
The Allies.
Including?
The United States, Great Britain, France, probably Australia.
How about the Soviet Union?
Yeah, that's right. And Italy? No, not Italy.
Germany?
No, the Nazis were in Germany. But what country contributed the most to defeating them?
America.
Which countries won the Second World War?
Oh, gosh. I don't know right off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
The Germany?
The Nazis were actually in Germany. Oh, it's actually it was Russia or the Soviet Union. They had the most casualties.
Yeah.
What's your reaction to that? Does that surprise you?
Just please don't put this on TV. I don't know that much about the Second World War. It's a shame, isn't it? American schools didn't teach me that much.
Meanwhile, right-wing activist wielding Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA, battle flags disrupted ceremonies in Kiev at the Park of Eternal Glory, while participants were laying flowers at the Eternal Flame to mark the anniversary of the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany. During its existence, the UPA fought against the Soviet Union, collaborating with Nazi forces in a fight against Soviet partisan units, hoping to create an independent Ukrainian state. The UPA was allied with the OUN, which played a substantial role in ethnic cleansing of the Polish population in Volhynia and eastern Galicia. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko met with veterans of both the Soviet Army and the UPA, along with current soldiers, including those of the anti-terrorist operation ATO, at a ceremony in Kiev Sunday. In a confused revision of history, Poroshenko reportedly thanked the veterans of both the UPA and the Soviet Army for their contribution to the fight against Nazi Germany. Poroshenko also used the opportunity to say to the ATO fighters, who were conducting a war against the ethnic Russian majority of the eastern part of Ukraine, that they could, quote, learn from their older colleagues, closed quote. In Korea, officials in the South were following the changes to the leadership in the North, which were announced during the ongoing party congress in Pyongyang, the first in 36 years. The DPRK's Workers' Party bestowed its top title on Kim Jong-un. CCTV's Shaim Ham reports from Seoul.
It shouldn't really come as a surprise to officials here. We've seen this move from the DPRK's previous leadership with Kim Il-sung, the country's founder and grandfather of the current leader, as well as his father, Kim Jong-il, who went through these motions step by step until ultimately, and that's where we see the consolidation of his authority. And that's why many experts are saying this is a symbolic gesture with this party congress this time around. But if what officials here are really looking out for in terms of officials here in South Korea is any mention of inter-Korean relations, any hints of possible policies that we could see in the months and years to come. And Kim Jong-un did mention that the DPRK is looking for self-reliant unification without any help from outside forces on the Korean Peninsula. Also, efforts made to carry out bilateral dialogue with the South on various levels and issues. But at this point, South Korea isn't interested in dialogue. The government here has made it very clear it's focused on enforcing and carrying out sanctions through the international community at this point.
Here in the U.S., the presidential primary season was in full play over the course of the weekend, with all of the remaining candidates trading barbs and the talking heads trading their opinions. As the Democratic and Republican conventions in July draw closer, and as the final leg of the primary season comes to a close, both Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have turned their attention to the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump.
I would be doing everything I could to make sure that the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party never gets near the White House.
What I think is most important is I would hope and expect that all of us understand that Donald Trump must not become president of the United States. And I am happy to tell you that Donald Trump will not become president of the United States. He will not become president of the United States because in every national poll that I have seen and in most statewide polls, we beat him by double-digit numbers. And if Democrats want to have the strongest candidate against Trump, they should look at those polls because in every single one of them, we beat Trump by a larger margin than does Clinton.
For his part, Trump has shown a clear preference to run against Hillary Clinton.
Can you imagine another 4 years of the Clintons? Seriously. Can you imagine? Seriously. It's time to move on, folks. We got to do it right. It's time to move on. And she's totally controlled by Wall Street and all the people that gave her these millions of dollars.
For more on that, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero from Philadelphia via Skype Monday. Professor Montero, welcome back.
Thank you, Don. It's good to be back.
So, since we last spoke, there have been some developments in the presidential campaign. We've had an opportunity to see how the media would deal with the idea of an apparently inevitable, although not yet in fact, inevitable Donald Trump candidacy for the Republicans. And even though nothing has really changed substantially in terms of mathematics with the Democrats, the idea of the inevitability of Clinton keeps being sold more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this selling of Hillary Clinton and the selling of the idea that her nomination is inevitable is a part of a real kind of ideological and psychological warfare against the people. I'm of the opinion that we've now entered the stage in this whole process where all of the anti-militarist anti-state repression, anti-neoliberal globalist forces must unite to stop Hillary Clinton. And I think the final front line in this will be the California primary, where the Sanders forces and the other forces have an opportunity to really deliver a serious tactical and even strategic blow to her movement to seize the nomination. And I want to underline seize the nomination, because if she gets it in what looks like a possibly brokered convention, it will be because of the weight of the anti-democratic superdelegates and rules that will be tightly controlled by Congresswoman Wasserman, Chairman Wasserman, and other elites, which will deliver the nomination to her. But everything has to be done to stop Hillary Clinton.
That kind of runs counter to the idea that's being sold that Trump is the one that needs to be stopped above all else. And the attempt by the Clinton forces in particular to, on the one hand, tell Sanders, okay, you have to sit down in the name of unity and everyone has to unite against Trump. What's the basis of your prioritizing stopping Clinton over stopping Trump?
Well, because I think what Clinton's candidacy, even at this point, represents is a alliance of forces the likes of which we have never seen. First of all, when the Koch brothers and the General Petraeus and the New York Times and the people supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership and private prisons and on and on come together, that should tell us something. What we're looking at is a corporatist, military, industrial, state repression alliance. Clinton is uniting the most dangerous forces in the Republican Party with the most dangerous forces in the Democratic Party. Her candidacy represents, and if she would be elected, her presidency would be the most dangerous from the standpoint of world peace and repression, the most dangerous presidency probably in the history of the United States.
Let's look at the foreign policy aspects of this, for example, because, of course, if there is a World War III, then the policy of presidents domestically is not so germane. You're talking about what are the conditions going to be like in the nuclear ash aftermath.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, this will be an election about international relationships, foreign policy, war policy, regime change, nation building, international trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and others. I think this election would be about that, because these huge international questions will determine what domestic policy will be, not the opposite. Now, of course, Clinton and her forces would want to obscure these international issues and make it all about statements that Trump has made or identity politics, be they feminist or, I should say sham feminist, sham black identity politics, and on and on and on. That's what they would want the campaign to be about. But what the real issues are the international question, the question of Syria. A Clinton presidency would mean a U.S. troops on the ground in Syria, a step up in troops on the ground in Iraq, a continuation and intensification of Afghanistan. And this is not to mention Ukraine and the expansion of NATO. This does not include North Korea and sanctions, stiffer sanctions against North Korea, and dangerous war games in the Pacific with China. So I think on the whole front of global politics, a Clinton administration would see war as the answer to all of the issues of international relationships. And that would impact the domestic scene from the standpoint of civil liberties. As you know, under the Obama administration, there was a toughening and of the attack, assault upon civil liberties, and so on. So we're looking at, in Hillary Clinton, perhaps the most dangerous figure, maybe in American history in 100 years. I mean, she goes way beyond Woodrow Wilson or Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon. This is the most dangerous political figure on the world scene today, and probably the most dangerous politician at the national level in American history.
You know, just in terms of trying to figure out the difference between bad and worse, which is unfortunately the kind of parsing that we have to do in American politics. You have Donald Trump saying things. He's, of course, got the America First whole, you know, exceptionalism language that's front and center in his campaign. The record of things, for example, like the ad against the Central Park Five and, you know, other things. And that is being thrown out by the Clinton campaign, again, as a need both for Sanders supporters to sit down and get in line behind Clinton, and for everyone to unify to stop Trump. But in terms of policy, things like Central Park Five, the whole question of mass incarceration, the question of throwing immigrants back into Latin America from the United States, there's a record of Clinton's policy, both Bill Clinton and Hillary's as Secretary of State, isn't there?
Yeah, and you know, Donald Trump has to answer for all of this stuff. But we're not talking about Donald Trump. We're talking about a movement to prevent world war or new wars in the Middle East and in Asia. We're talking about a movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're talking about a movement against this evil cabal, this new alliance of the Koch brothers, the Bush family, the Clintons, the military in the person of, let us say, a David Petraeus, who is on board with more interventionism in Iraq, in Syria, more troops on the ground, more regime change, more nation building. We're talking about an alliance that brings Victoria Nuland, the diplomat, and I put quotes around that, behind the coup d'etat, the fascist coup d'etat in Ukraine. Victoria Nuland, who supports the toughening of NATO in Eastern Europe and provoking Russia, a kind of a brinksmanship in Eastern Europe. So when you put all of this together, and I'm saying, Don, that this will be an election about the future of America's role in the world and how that will be manifested. And I'm saying that Hillary Clinton and the forces behind her are committed to resolving all of the problems that humanity faces and nations face between one another through war and aggression and intervention.
In terms of the inevitability of Hillary Clinton as a Democratic nominee, certainly the arithmetic doesn't support it on the one hand. They say even when they show all of the delegates, both superdelegates and earned delegates in Clinton's column and Sanders' earned delegates in the other, they're preparing the masses for an outcome where the superdelegates award it to Clinton. But even when they do that, they say, but of course, Sanders has a very narrow opportunity to win this. In fact, if there is a brokered convention, all bets are off, and the general sentiment of the voters can be taken into account along with the likelihood of the Democrat beating the Republican, which all polls favor Sanders on that score. Is it possible that we're going to see the leadership hand it to Clinton despite the fact that she would be more vulnerable to a Trump victory at the same time that they're saying this must be done to keep Trump out? And do you think Democrats will sit for that?
Well, one thing is clear, that the elites, the ruling class and the military, have decided, for the most part, upon Hillary Clinton. And they're going all out to make her the nominee and, in fact, the president of the United States. And that's because she represents their agenda against the people. However, the people have a lot to say, and there's a lot of time left. And California will be the final battleground to ensure that this convention, the Democratic Party convention in Philadelphia, will be a brokered convention. Now, there are plans, and I put quotes, to march on the Democratic Party. I think the marches have to be more focused. The march has to be to stop Hillary Clinton. Some people are making arguments, well, all Democrats are the same, that Bernie Sanders is a Democrat, Hillary Clinton is a Democrat, they're all the same, and it is the Democratic Party as such that we have to condemn and attack. And Bernie Sanders is not very different. Well, the fact of the matter is that people who make these kind of arguments do not see the people, do not see insurgency, do not see anger of the people. And therefore, in kind of an elitist and almost petty bourgeois sense, come to the conclusion that that it's all the same, that we have that we don't have a dog in this fight. The fact of the matter is we have to stop Hillary Clinton. And if we don't stop her at the Philadelphia convention, we have to stop her in November. And that will require a huge and sophisticated united front of the people against war and against repression and against neoliberal globalization.
And finally, how do we get from here to there? We're going to see whatever happens in Cleveland. I have a suspicion from watching the machinations on the news channels, CNN, Fox, whatever, that the Republican Party elites have not yet gone gently into that good night on the question of Trump as a nominee. So there'll be some games probably played there unless Trump really trounces those who are no longer running in the coming weeks. And then, of course, we go to Philadelphia, where the entire drama is going to take place that will determine whether it's Clinton or Sanders or perhaps someone else that emerges as the Democratic candidate. What are we supposed to be doing during that?
Yeah, I think it's like this. I think a good part of the Republican Party elite will either sit on their hands, which means support for Clinton, or openly come out in support of Clinton. The Bushes have already done so. Probably Mitt Romney, probably McCain, Lindsey Graham, I think, will be in the Clinton camp. Certainly a good part of the so-called conservative intellectuals within the Republican Party, like David Brooks, like Charles Krauthammer, and some others, will certainly be with Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton will run as a fusion of Republicans and right-wing Democrats, but the substantive thing is that it will be an alliance of the militarists, the war party, and the neoliberal globalists. Now, I'm suggesting that if she gets the nomination, and probably before that, I think people in the Trump insurgency and people in the Sanders insurgency on the local levels must begin meeting and discussing united front tactics going forward. I think this must include all of the independent parties, be they Libertarian, be they the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the Workers' World Party, or whoever else has a candidate in the race. But it has to be built upon the insurgent movements, the people who are leading the democracy spring, the workers who are losing their jobs because of neoliberal globalization, the Verizon workers, and on and on and on. This is what we have to put together, because if we do not, Clinton will represent, as president, a disaster for the people. It's going to be a hard sell for a lot of people in the left, I think, but I think it will be a less hard sell for those people involved in the insurgency movement on both sides of this. The other thing is that I think we should encourage those people who registered Republican to vote for Trump to now re-register as Democrats to vote for Sanders. That independence, I think California is an open state, so they can vote in the primary. And others who were thinking about sitting on the fence, that they join in the fight in California in particular to deliver a resounding blow, a resounding defeat for Clinton, which I think will then guarantee a brokered convention in Philadelphia, and then for Philadelphia, the forces organizing against Hillary come to Philadelphia and march in the tens of thousands to stop Hillary Clinton and send that message to the superdelegates and to the delegates in general here in Philadelphia.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
There are still 11 more primaries to be set for the Democrats. This Tuesday, May 10th, we'll see a primary in West Virginia, and two on May 17th, a week later, in Kentucky and Oregon. Sunday, June 5th, we'll see Puerto Rico go to the polls, and on June 7th, California, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, and North and South Dakota will vote. The primary season will close out in Washington, D.C. on June 14th, and we will be covering all of those as they develop. That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.